welcome to The Foxhole, a show that brings you insights into hot topics, lifestyle design tips, and tactics for success.
So for the past couple of years, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about customer acquisition, I run a couple of different software platforms for people that want to build apps and connect with their fans and their customers and all this stuff. And so a big part of my responsibility in running these companies is trying to get the word out there and trying to get people to become aware of the service, to learn about the service, to get it in front of people who could make use of it and want to become paying customers of it. And I think in the online world, but also broadly the offline world, as increasingly like more and more of people's time and energy is going into being online, and that's where their attention is going, even what were traditionally just brick and mortar offline only businesses need to have presence online and need to be looking online to acquire those new customers, new fans. And so in all of these, online and offline, there are like probably a good 20-ish different sort of channels for acquiring new customers or for getting the word out there. And some of them are, they're each kind of like specialties unto themselves. You can hire consultants or firms that specialize in specifically viral marketing or email marketing, or they'll do search engine optimization for you. And each one of these different channels is a sort of like discipline unto itself. And each one works differently for whatever your business might be. Email marketing might be really great for you if you are offering a sort of software service or an app service, whereas offline ads like billboards and display ads on bus stops might be a really great option for you if you're running a local, like a ice cream shop or something like that. So something that we've been talking about a lot lately is spending some time diving into these different customer acquisition channels and exploring how to be effective with them. Especially in a sort of like introductory, like here's a simple way to get started with some of these things. And in my experience over the past few years, running a software company and mostly connecting to folks online, I've had a lot of sort of experience with a smaller subset of these overall acquisition channels. And I'd like to spend some upcoming episodes really just diving into them specifically. And the ones that I'm really familiar with are, and that I've had a lot of success with most importantly, are email marketing, social and display advertising, so displaying on like Facebook or Twitter, search engine optimization, search engine marketing, which are like ads placed on search engines, and then community and content marketing. So those are things I've had experience with. Those are ones I'm probably going to want to like dive into a little more. And we might even bring some guests onto the show who are really talented at some of these things. And that's kind of where I'm at on those big items.
What is what would you consider community content marketing?
Well, so there's like content marketing would be writing a blog, making a podcast, things like that, where you're producing content in your that people in your industry would be interested in consuming. So maybe, you know, if you are a craft beer brand, producing a blog about the process that includes topics on the process of making beer, or video content on that production process would be considered content marketing, because the goal is just to get people who would be advocates of your brand and hopefully customers to like look at that content, consume that content, and share it with others. And so the degree to which you can create compelling and like viral content, will be the degree to which you're successful with that kind of strategy. Community building as a customer acquisition method would be to create a community around your brand and to kind of give them tools and facilitate the process of getting folks talking with one another and you, hopefully. Great example of this is like Know Your Company, which is kind of like an offshoot or kind of like a subsidiary of Basecamp. They run a community called the Water Cooler, which is a leadership community for folks in the small business world. And so if you go to, I think it's thewatercooler.io, you can apply to be a member there and join their community. And it's just a forum where executives and leaders from companies are able to post about recruiting and policy and all kinds of, all the sort of stuff that you might want to seek information out from others when it comes to running a business. You can kind of find that there. And so because they're building this community for leaders, they're also exposing all of those people to Know Your Company, which is a sort of employee satisfaction tool that helps you kind of to track how healthy and happy your organization is, I think. So that's kind of what community building is. And it works well for some brands and has subtleties to making it be effective. And if you do it well, having a community around your thing is one of the most powerful positions you can be in and one of the most sticky sort of acquisition channels you could have.
Well, I think you understand that better than anyone else.
Well, we've seen it a lot. That was kind of the insight that got us into this whole business we've been in since 2012 or so, was that building online communities was a great way to drive commerce. And we've been investing a lot of time and energy into technology and that approach, and it seems to be true across different industries. I mean, we've seen this technology kind of work everywhere, from food trucks to fan club to like performing artist fan clubs. So that one is a good one for sure. And then there are a bunch of other, like I said, I mean, I'm familiar with a handful of these sort of acquisition channels and have direct experience with them, but you've also got things like speaking engagements, going to trade shows, affiliate programs, business development. I mean, there's like so many different ways to kind of get the word out there.
So what about SEO? Like, what is that? Let's give people like a high level view.
So like a lot of people discover local businesses or they still, when they're looking for a solution to a problem they might have, they still go to Google and they'll type. A great example is my friend runs a print studio here in Los Angeles. And if you Google for fine art printing Los Angeles, his company dominates like that first list of results that comes back. So the goal is really just to have your business or your product or your service be among the first results that show up when people search for solutions to their problems that you can service. And the tricky thing about search engine optimization is that the order of those results and whether your business shows up in them gets determined inside of a black box at Google that nobody but their internal engineering staff has access to or knowledge about, really. So you don't really know positively what is going to get you to that top result. And because there's a black box and because nobody really knows, there's this whole industry of SEO optimization and firms that will do SEO for you.
Do you think these firms know the secret sauce?
Well, yeah, there are best practices. You know, there are sort of best practices that are low-hanging fruit that just about anybody can implement and that will help to improve your score. But anybody who's guaranteeing that they can get you to the top result slot or that has some sort of voodoo magical insight into this stuff, there are a lot of people who are cautious about getting scammed in that world just because it's very difficult to quantify and to deliver on because nobody really has direct access to that algorithm and to those placements. But there are best practices. You know, there are things that you can do in the way that your website is set up, in the way that you link to things, that will improve your chances of being higher ranked in search results. And so that's the whole game there, is just to be prominently featured in search results when people are searching for the things that have to do with your business.
So one question that comes up often is related to SEO is, do I need a website? And I think the obvious answer there is yes, but
yeah.
Do you think that's the best starting point for going down that road?
Yeah, I don't think that there is really any other way, because if you don't have, you need to absolutely have some kind of online presence. And when I say online presence, I don't mean a Facebook profile or a Yelp profile. You need to have your own dedicated website with your own URL. And that's the starting point for almost everything, really. I mean, it's certainly the starting point for SEO optimization or SEO. And if you want to do things like search engine marketing, which is placing ads directly in search results as another way to sort of get visibility there, you need to be able to drive people to a landing page, to your website, to your own thing. So yeah, absolutely, getting a website is step one. And you can get a website, I mean, you can use Squarespace, depending on what your needs are and how sophisticated your business is. Even a simple Squarespace site would suffice as having a home on the web. But you should have your own domain name and definitely your own website. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't be present on Facebook and all these other things. You should absolutely be present on all the social media channels. But along with all those things, you should certainly have a home on the web.
Now, this may seem like an obvious thing, especially to someone like you or myself who are in technology. But for those small business owners that are not necessarily or not so tech savvy, why is it important to have an online presence?
Because zooming out from just having whether you should be online or not, in order to be competitive, your business has to be differentiated. You know, your products should ideally be better than your competitors' products. Your marketing should be better than your competitors' marketing, all those things. Like, you want to be competitive across the board. And part of being competitive is being differentiated. And so if you're using the same tools as all of your other competitors, so if everybody's using a Facebook page, everybody's using the same tools, and so nobody can really differentiate beyond what is provided to you and beyond what is going on in the Facebook ecosystem. So it's very difficult in such a setting to do things like test different marketing messages and see which one works the best. On Facebook in particular, and increasingly social media across the board, all these sort of networks, something that they don't really tell you, or something that's not immediately obvious at the outset, is that just because you get a fan there, or just because you drive somebody there, doesn't mean you can easily reach out to and communicate with that person again in the future. So for instance, like most business pages, when you create a post inside of a business page on Facebook, naturally, like organically, without you spending any money, it reaches about 2% of your followers, the people who are like likes, the people who liked your page or sort of like follow your page. And so in order for you to get that to be seen by more of your followers, these people who like ostensibly you've earned that follow, that like, or whatever, you've that relationship has been opted into and established.
So you're saying,
and
if someone has 1,000 followers, only 20 people are seeing that post statistically and organically.
Yeah. So like if you post it into your feed, Facebook will show it to between like 1-3%, I think is the number. And then they want you to like boost that post to show it to more people. And boosting means paying $20 or whatever in order to get more of your Facebook fans.
And is that
2%
just because of their own Facebook's own algorithms?
Yeah, it's Facebook's algorithm that determines all of this stuff. Because the truth is that with all the friends that you have on Facebook and all the brands that you follow on Facebook, there are thousands of pieces of content. I saw this, I think Zuckerberg or somebody mentioned this recently, but there are a couple thousand pieces of content they could conceivably show you every day. And there's no way that a single person has time every day to go through 2,000 pieces of content, right? Like, I feel like I get a fraction of that in email and I have a hard time keeping up with it. And so they have to prioritize what posts they show you one way or another. And so And increasingly, and this is the other tricky part of it, is that you don't have any say over it. There are businesses that are amazing businesses one day, but then because of a change in how Facebook views its business model or they change an algorithm, your news business or your content business goes away completely overnight. And so it's important to have like your own home on the web, like your own website, a destination that you control every pixel of it. You determine what the rules are going to be, whether people, you know, like what content, like you, when you build your home on somebody else's platform, you're completely at the mercy of their own policy changes. So that's just another reason why it's so important to have your own website.
Like I hadn't considered it before, but now that you were talking about it, when I think of, I don't follow many, or like, I guess is the, what they call it, many businesses on Facebook, but out of the few that I do, I can't remember one time that a post has shown up in my newsfeed from any of those that I've seen.
That's the thing, right? But everybody's so focused, oh, you got to be, you know, you got to be building your Facebook followers. They think that getting a bunch of likes on Facebook, getting a bunch of followers on Facebook, or getting a bunch of followers on Instagram is equivalent to making sales or building a business or building like a following that you can really directly interact with. But it's very difficult to reach those people, and it becomes more difficult and expensive every day to reach the own, like your own fans, your own people who have opted in to read, to look at your thing.
And this is why it's so important for you to have your own independent online presence.
Exactly. In addition to all of the other stuff, you know, not to replace it.
To use to promote your online presence.
Exactly. To drive people from those platforms to your thing. Like, people should be going to your website or your app, like your fans, your customers, your fans, those that you want to interact with you, they should be going to somewhere on the web that you own and that they're registering and giving you their information, not Facebook, not some other platform who's going to keep it from you, and with whom you can have a very direct relationship, both in terms of the content and what you want to communicate to those folks, but also in terms of the products and services that you want to offer them. As soon as you're listing your products and services on some aggregator platform, from Amazon to Postmates to Facebook to, I mean, you go on and on, you are giving control over your business and your destiny to a third party that doesn't care about you individually. And in the case of something like Facebook, is more than willing to just abruptly sever their relationship with you or reprioritize their own thinking on where your business and needs fall as it relates to their business and needs. And it's a very precarious place to be for small businesses.
And for clarification, what's the difference between, because you mentioned a customer and a fan, what's the difference between those two?
Yeah, there's a passion thing. Like, a fan is somebody who I think is passionate about your thing, and a customer is somebody who buys your thing. Like, there are a lot of things that I buy that I'm not passionate about. Like, I'm not like passionate about my mouthwash, but I buy mouthwash, so I'm a customer there. But I'm certainly a fan of like the clothes I wear, and so I am and I go to like my clothing company's subreddit community to connect to other people who are weird like me, you know, and that's what's cool. Like, the thing is, like, everybody has their own sort of interests and they want to go deep on whatever those interests are. And the thing about the internet and things like Reddit and the scale of everything, the billions of people that are connected to the web nowadays, is that no matter how obscure your kink is, you'll find people out there that are also into it and you can connect to them. And so, like, that idea of fandom and the ability to, and the opportunity to cultivate fandom is available today in an unprecedented way. You know, it used to be that, like, to get fans, you would have to, there were very few distributors of, like, fame and influence and information, right? So, like, taking fans, like a traditional way of thinking of fans, is like in the music industry. And it used to be that if you wanted to be, have a career in music, and it still kind of is this way, but less so. But if you wanted to have a degree or a career in music, you would need to get signed by a label who would then put you on this sort of conveyor belt into stardom through this whole sort of like distribution chain that very few parties had access to. But nowadays, anybody can just go online and just upload something and connect to people who might be fans of it. And it was most natural for that stuff to happen first in content type communities, you know, like the people who had already had fan clubs. Like, it was very easy for music to find fans online and provide fan experiences for them. But again, this idea of the rise of micro brands, I think in the same way that musicians in the last several decades have had sort of musical fans, like, you're going to have fans like that around brands, lifestyle brands, clothing brands, like whatever, just like anything out there.
Okay, so we've talked about the need for having a website and the importance of having a website. Another question that comes up for small business owners is, do I need an app?
It depends on the small business. You know, if you're a customer, if you're a consumer-facing brand, so if you run an e-commerce store, if you have a brick-and-mortar retail business where you're selling clothing or tea or, like, whatever, if you're selling stuff to people, yes, you should definitely have an app. And the reason that I say you should have an app is because of all of the different kinds of technology we have available to us right now, it is the one that affords the most deep engagement possible. You can send people push notifications. You can create these really engaging experiences around your product. You can put videos in there. You can put, you know, if you want to educate people about your products and show them off in the, or services and show them off in the best light, you can really add a lot of rich media, interactive type stuff to a mobile experience like that, which is going to overall increase your image, the amount of people that trust your services and products. It raises the degree of professionalism around your whole thing. And overall just gives you the strongest tool set to connect with your fans. But an app should be implemented alongside of everything else. You should also have a mailing list. You should also have a website. You should also have social media accounts. And all of these things should be tied together with a cohesive strategy.
Now, why an app versus a website that's mobile optimized? And can you, like, articulate what mobile optimization is?
When people talk about something being mobile optimized, they just mean that it works well on a mobile phone or a tablet. A lot of websites and most of the whole web, the advent of mobile and smartphones kind of happened decades after we started working on the web. And so the web never had to accommodate, like, websites never had to accommodate tiny screens. And so for a long time, there was this transition that occurred where websites that were designed and built to be very large and display on very large computer screens now had to be retrofitted to display really nicely on a small, tiny mobile screen. And because of that difference in real estate, every fundamental thing we had figured out about navigating a website and how to make it look and work had to be kind of rethought for mobile. And I would be surprised to hear of anything that was being built that wasn't mobile first or mobile optimized one way or another. And so that's what it means when you say we have a mobile optimized website. You can look at it on an iPhone or an Android device and it looks really good and works really well. Now, the difference between websites and apps, it comes down to the amount of functionality within mobile operating systems that these two experiences can access. So websites can't do push notifications. You can only do push notifications through an app. Websites can't access the camera. You can't do, you couldn't build Snapchat on a website. So there's all kinds of software type features that you can't access from a website that prevent you from creating really immersive experiences. And then historically, websites haven't had access to things like Apple Pay, which is like that one click, just super simple purchasing with Apple. But that has, they've brought Apple Pay into mobile Safari. So now you can do that stuff. And they're gradually dialing up what you can do from a website. But having an app is really great also because there's this whole category of search engine optimization called ASO, which is App Store Optimization. And you'll find that having an app, having a presence in app stores today is almost a little bit like being really early on the web, where people are searching the app store for all kinds of stuff. It's surprising. Like we've seen people searching for very obscure things in huge numbers on app stores. It's kind of like a little secret. And so having an app for things like that, these sort of ancillary benefits that aren't immediately obvious, is great too. And so I would say, yeah, having an app is as important, if it makes sense for your business, as having a website or social media accounts.
So App Store optimization, is that where, similar to SEO, where you're basically putting certain keywords in your description to try to manipulate the results of your app popping up?
Yeah. ASO is exactly SEO, but instead of happening on Google's search engine for website results, it's happening inside of Apple's App Store for App Store results. And Google has an app, Google has Google Play, where they do search results for apps as well. And so it's all about crafting profile terms and keywords and all of that good stuff in order to improve your listings on app stores. But where the web is super duper saturated with websites, app stores are a little less saturated, especially when it comes to small businesses. You know, so for instance, if you were looking for like pizza places in Santa Monica or something with apps, like there aren't a lot of pizza places in Santa Monica that have apps. And so yours, if you have one, is much more likely to show up. And so we see crazy, 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 crazy numbers in some cases when it comes to organic downloads on apps.
That was a lot of really great information for businesses in general, but certainly small businesses.
I mean, I kind of want to emphasize that too, is that each of these deserves its own. I could spend a lot of time talking about email marketing unto itself.
So we'll continue to delve deeper into some of these additional, more common customer acquisition channels. I'm looking forward to the social display advertising.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see what happens there. I mean, so much of what's happening right now, Zuckerberg, I think as we're recording this, is being grilled by Congress. And so I'm wondering, in the wake of all of this user privacy data and advertiser controversy, what's going to happen to the market for online advertising? I don't think anything is really going to change, though. I don't think it's going to have an impact on much of that
like
stuff.
From a regulation standpoint?
From the standpoint of those tools becoming any less effective or changing in any meaningful way, I don't think much of that's going to happen. I think a lot of stuff's going to happen on the consumer front with transparency and, who's to say what's going to happen? But I think that the tools are going to be available. They're not going to take away internet advertising from us.
So what's going on with Mark Zuckerberg? What's happening over there?
I think the biggest theme is that it's a very public opportunity for everybody to voice their complaints and concerns about the Facebook platform. I mean, I saw him field questions from a few different senators, and everybody's bringing up the points that we've all been discussing and all the things that have disgusted us where it comes to our privacy and how people are being manipulated by these services at scale. But Mark had really good prepared answers. And the thing is, like, I don't feel like a lot of this stuff I really don't feel like they're doing anything evil. Certainly it's distasteful on some level. But I think that they genuinely want to do good in the world. Mark Zuckerberg is certainly signaling that they're ready to be regulated, that he literally said that they're going to propose regulation. Like Facebook will draft up some regulation.
Like he himself or his
suggestions? Well, his team, somebody on his team is going to propose something, because what they were asking is if they were going to implement the European regulation. So Europe has introduced some kind of consumer privacy protection stuff that big tech companies have to implement. And I don't know the specifics of it, but they were asking him, like, are you going to implement those European guidelines globally? Like, is this something that you guys are going to roll out across the world? And do you think it's a good set of regulations? And Mark was like, You know, they got some things right. You know, I think that if we were going to roll those out in the United States, it would look a little different because we have different sensibilities in America. So they're going to wind up getting regulated, I think. And the trouble with that, though, is like that's not going to be a slap on the wrist at Facebook. It's going to be really, depending on what it looks like, what these regulations for technology companies look like, it might make it harder to start and grow tech companies. Like the real losers in all of this might actually be startups. Because if all of a sudden we have to comply with all kinds of weird, not weird, but if we have to comply with a lot of overwrought regulatory, like compliance things, like you've got to build a system to make it super easy for people to export their data and like a long list of items that you have to engineer or otherwise allocate resources to, Facebook has very deep pockets. They can spend any amount of money in order to be in compliance. But a startup, you know, it's all that you can do to feed yourself in some cases. And so to have to allocate energy, time, and money or labor to like a sophisticated user privacy and data management system when you're just trying to see if your like photo app is going to have any traction at all, lest you might get fined or something. I mean, that's kind of a scary future. Or that's something that would at least inhibit innovation. But the good news is that everybody, Zuckerberg and the people grilling him, acknowledged that while they see regulation as the way forward, they don't want to introduce anything that's going to stifle innovation. Part of me suspects that all of this is just a spectacle, though. I feel like all these deals were cut, you know, because he went and had meetings with the majority of the people, I believe, in that room talking to him.
Like he
had,
like,
one-on-ones with all these people like yesterday or the day before. Like, and they've had a huge, you know, they have the best political operatives probably in the world working for Facebook. And so all of this, I think, has probably already been sorted out behind closed doors. And then what we're watching now is just the sort of like part where everybody gets to, all the politicians get to have their moment on the air, taking the businessman to task, you know, to please their constituents. Zuckerberg gets to make a very public statement on all of these issues, and he's doing a very good job of it. And because it's a spectacle, I mean, like, the when you look at it, it's like he's sitting at this desk and he's surrounded by like a half circle of the most powerful people, you know, in our government, or some of the most, you know, most powerful people in our government getting grilled. It's like he's got like the, it really looks like a trial or something, you know. So from a PR perspective, this probably couldn't be going better for Facebook.
Okay, so let's talk about health a little bit. Some health stuff.
Yeah.
All the things you've always wanted to know. Oh, well, maybe not you, right. But I'm sure you have some of your own. So one question I get asked from time to time at the gym in the ladies' locker room is, how do I stay fit? And I've even had a follow-up, is it genetic? And so I'm not going to talk about necessarily the workouts right now. We can talk about that another time, and just exercise in general, or my personal workout routines. But on the greater percentage, the first answer is diet. So your diet, and when I say diet, I'm not talking about some like Atkins, all carb, all not all carb, all protein. Imagine that, an all carb diet. All protein kind of diet. I'm just, when I say diet, I'm referring to like your general eating habits and how you eat throughout the day. And how that is more, I would argue that is more important than any workout or any workout routine or exercise that you do for regulating weight and in your body. And so I've kind of had this rule for, since I can remember, that I implement and I break from time to time, of course. You know, you have to indulge once in a while, as you've seen me do at DK's. but it's no cheese, no soda, no saucy condiments.
No saucy condiments?
Yes, like ranch dressing or ketchup.
Oh, got
it. So, in general, this is how I, you know, in a typical day, these are my rules that I follow for myself and make a huge difference as it adds up in the small things. So I'll kind of like give you an example, right? So take like a typical day or what could be a typical day for someone. You wake up, you have an omelet. You go to lunch and you maybe get a salad. And for dinner, you have a burger. Now, implement my rule. So you don't have cheese on your omelet, you don't have ranch dressing on your salad, and you don't have any cheese on your burger or any ketchup. By eliminating, and I don't drink soda, so this is a really easy one for me, but for those of you that add the soda, that's just like a whole extra thing. Like say you have a soda pop with your burger or something. And it's the same, whether it's Diet Coke or diet soda or regular soda, it doesn't matter because the diet soda just gives you cravings. And so it's just as bad as having the one that is full of sugar.
Soda is my only, man, of all, I generally eat pretty well. But soda is the one that gets me every once in a while. That's like the one vice that I have. So delicious.
Soda. Yes. Thankfully it's just never been something that I've, you know, it wasn't in my house growing up. We didn't really have soda in the house much. And I just, you know, my parents didn't really give it to me as a kid. And so I never really developed any great desire for it. So, okay, you eliminated the cheese in the omelet. A single slice of cheese is anywhere from 100 to 150 calories, depending on what it is, and 30% of your saturated fat. And when we talk about percentages of fat, we're talking about like the recommended daily allowance. Dressing, like just let's just say ranch dressing, for example, depending on the brand, can be anywhere from 145 to 300 calories for 2 tablespoons. And like imagine like pulling out a tablespoon and drizzling that over your salad. Most people probably actually use more than that.
Wait, how many calories did you say?
Anywhere from 145 to 300. I've seen as high as 300 before.
300. And like you're, how many calories do you budget per day?
Well, it depends on how,
for like intake?
That depends on how much you're working out. And what you're doing, because it could be anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000, right, in some cases. But they say that on average, 2,000 is like a great number to go by.
But you're saying a teaspoon of ranch could be like 10% of your intake, your caloric intake? Mm-hmm.
And as high as 60% of your saturated fat. I've seen it as high as that.
Wow.
So
I could just chug a bottle of ranch in the morning and call it a day?
I do not recommend that.
If I didn't care about the fat part, no?
Don't recommend it.
Okay.
Right. So basically we eliminated the cheese from the omelet, the ranch from the salad, and the cheese and ketchup from the burger. And we could argue about taste and flavor in a minute. We're actually going to talk about that. But essentially what you just eliminated from your day between those three, and if you do have soda, we eliminated the Coke. You just eliminated 750 calories, just calories alone. Plus.
Okay, and that's, wait, and one more time, it's no.
No cheese.
No sauce, no cheese, no soda.
No cheese, no soda, no saucy condiments.
Saucy. Wait a minute, you don't eat cheese?
From time to time, but very rarely. When I eat cheese, I eat like a cheese platter with my wine. That's when you'll see me eat cheese.
Like I get,
but I balance it out with everything else that I'm doing. So if I know like, okay, I'm going to have, you know, I'm going to a wine tasting, for example, and I know I'm going to have cheese. And so like what I eliminate anything else during the day that would kind of make up like for that category. But in general, no, like this is my, like my way for staying fit. I'm going to have a burger. I'm not going to put cheese on it. I'm going to have a delicious omelet. I'm not going to put cheese on it. Right. Or I'm going to have, you know, the salad, but I don't put Thousand Island or ranch or any of these like creamy dressings on my salad.
I see.
So this is your typical day. This is what you've eliminated. So you've just eliminated 750 calories, additional calories, additional, right? Because that's above and beyond the calories that's in the food itself. You've eliminated 120% of saturated fat, which means if you actually ate this and did not eliminate these things, you've gone like way overboard on your saturated fat, which is a horrible fat for you. And you've also eliminated over 45 grams of sugar. Now, most of...
Sugar is the real killer, right? Isn't sugar like the...
Yeah, sugar.
The worst thing
we can
nowadays.
Have a whole episode on sugar. But the majority of the sugar came from the Coke, right? Because there's 39 grams of sugar in a Coca-Cola. And just to give you like an example, take a teaspoon, fill it with sugar. That's about 4 grams of sugar.
A teaspoon of sugar is 4 grams.
Yeah. So like basically a tablespoon of ketchup is essentially the same as like a teaspoonful of sugar. That's about 4 grams of sugar.
What?
Yeah. So imagine like, you know, having that teaspoonful of sugar and sprinkling it over your French fries
or your burger. Why? Why is ketchup so high in sugar? Is it just for flavor?
You know, sugar is added to a lot of things just to get you addicted, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
So anyway, so this is a really simple thing that you can do. And this is what I do myself the majority of the time. If you want to just have a little bit better of a diet. And you can see it's a little here and a little there, but all of this adds up to a tremendous amount of decrease in calories, fat, and sugar from your regular day-to-day.
Okay. Well, that seems really simple to follow.
Yeah. I have friends who are like, oh, I'm trying to lose weight. And then, you know, we'll go to lunch, they'll order salad, and then they're pouring this ranch dressing all over their salad. And I'm like, do you realize what you're doing?
Oh,
you know, like
you know, that's kind of not obvious.
It's not
I can
obvious.
See how people would make that mistake.
Exactly. It's not obvious. Now, as far as flavor goes, and this is like the other thing where people argue like, oh, but then there's no taste. But like real food actually tastes good. You know, if you have a salad and you want to add flavor, you don't need to pour ranch dressing all over it. You can add some fruit like strawberries or blue or peaches or something to your salad. You can add seasonings, you know, a little salt and pepper. You can add even balsamic vinegar and like a dash of olive oil, you know, like a healthy fat, and this can make it delicious. Same thing with your burger.
And it takes a little bit. Yeah. And there's also a small transition period, right? Where you're like acclimating to a different flavor profile than just like a mountain of sugar and chemicals and, you know,
You can baby step it, you know, cut out.
Well, I just feel like you start to, it's almost like, I don't want to call it like an acquired taste, but you almost start to appreciate the subtlety of those new flavors in a way.
Yeah.
Like if you...
Yeah, people see me eat my salad and they're like, how do you eat that with no dressing? And I'm like, I actually enjoy the flavor of lettuce.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's interesting.
So that's...
Why aren't there more... That seems like a really simple... prescription for healthier eating, where I feel like most things that I see on the internet are a lot more complex. Whenever I like glance at or come across some kind of like health craze or
it doesn't have to like be complicated. We'll talk about more very simple health tips you can implement in your daily life to feel better, look better, and whatnot. But that's what we have for today.
Thanks for tuning in. For more information, head over to foxhole.fm. That's foxhole.fm. If you have any questions, please email us at feedback@foxhole.fm. And if you're enjoying what you hear, please leave us a great review on your favorite podcast platform or iTunes. Thanks again for listening.